I want to welcome you to the third on a session on work. This is the question of work and morality, civil rights, and business ethics. And my name is Christine George. I am not a, what is the word, ethicist at all. And but in my work, just in my day-to-day work, and in my work for 10 years as a union rep, and also in the last 3 years, working on women's health issues and on the issue of AIDS, a whole lot of questions start to come up in my mind, as they do, I think, in all of our minds, are the questions about our morals or our ethics on one hand and the workplace on the other. It's something we see in every aspect in our life. So when I had a chance to put together what I wanted to do on work, I thought this would be a very appropriate place to have a discussion with other people on the subject. And so I hope, like the session we had last night on unions, that this is more of a discussion rather than just a presentation from myself. And I think a good way to start it would be people to go around and just introduce yourselves and what kind of work you do.
I'm Peter Rothog. I am a computer operator for the Postal Service.
Jan Carr, I'm currently a student. Formerly, I worked for Accounts Receivable Law Corporation.
Betty Honeyman, English teacher.
Sue Johnson, fifth grade teacher.
Floyd Nave, professor in college. Late. Retired now as of June.
And clicking his heels.
Leanne Trost, graduate student and various part-time work kinds of things.
Linda Ray Watts, determine eligibility for financial, medical, and social programs for the disabled, the incapacitated, the unemployed, etc.
Well, Cindy Larson, I teach remedial reading.
I'm Dick Swanson, I teach at Mankato State University.
I'm Jim Sheeler, I'm a sales rep for Pepsi-Cola.
My name is Rick Freetop, I'm a lawyer in Seattle.
Okay. You know, we all have values in our lives. At least I hope we all have values in our lives, images of what we would like society to be, what we would like ourselves to be. I have a question, though, about the door once we get to work and how much of these we leave outside the workplace door, either because we think they're not appropriate there, that it's not really our place, or because we think that we'd be fairly powerless, which is maybe two sides of the same coin. And I'd be real interested, just to go around for a second again, and for people to give an example, either from your work or just from your observations, of where you think that there are examples of conflicts or where these kind of issues come up in terms of work and morality. Anything. I mean, it can be in the newspapers. It can be something that happened to you.
Well, in academia, there's always a tension that exists between faculty and administration. It has been historically that way, and it will always be that way. So there's
Do you mean like a tension between them sort of looking at the business end and you saying, well, I have a quality product that I have to teach?
I think faculty people like to think of themselves as being in a calling, and in fact, the university or the college. Yet there is one aspect of it where the administration treats you as if you are an employee. So there's something sort of different, and I think that tension is always there. And when I have talked with many of my colleagues, that has very commonly come up in the discussion.
The vocation.
Interesting to hear remarks back.
Oh, yeah, totally. All the ministries are real, real, real bad apples, and we're just wonderful guys. Stroke each other. No, that's generally true. It shouldn't be that way. same thing.
Can people think of other examples?
Well, I would think it doesn't matter what job, but there's always a conflict between employees and their supervisors and management.
Something a little different. Practically every worker in my field in the state detests Evergreen Legal Services in Seattle. Really, it's the state legislatures who write the ridiculous laws, the administrators and theorists who decide how to implement the laws and tell us how to do it. We do it. Then we're told what we've done is wrong. Injunctions and lawsuits and all this gets slapped on. We have to undo all the wonderful work we've done on forced overtime. It's just wonderful. Why don't they give us... Oh, and then they give us the rules. August 15th that went into effect June 1st. Thanks for telling us on time. The bureaucratic system that prevents you doing the job you should be able to do because everybody else gives you the wrong information. And it's kind of frustrating.
That would be.
I'm putting bureaucratic system people's rights. An example I have of that, you know, when you were saying that, it brought up to me, is that when I represented workers in mental hospitals, and in particular psychologists, who were the people who would make the evaluation whether a patient was ready to go back on the streets or not, and Illinois had a very strong move toward deinstitutionalizations in which they were decreasing the amount of people in their mental hospitals, putting them on psychotropic drugs, and supposedly putting them in halfway houses, many of whom did not exist. But they developed rules and regulations and also developed a budget structure, which meant that the only way the system would work is for a certain number of people to be released. So there was a great deal of pressure on the psychologist to have actually a quota system in terms of the number of people they released, and yet there was their personal belief or evaluation as professionals of the appropriateness of releasing people. And a whole lot of disciplinary action, a whole lot of evaluating people for promotions, you know, they wouldn't get a promotion, and then looking back in their record why they didn't get one, a whole lot of tension between supervisors came over that subject, you know, and whether it was appropriate or not, you know, was this an independent professional who would make a decision whether this person should be on the streets or not, you know, or could they be ordered to put the person back on the streets? And then, if they did it inappropriately, then were they legally responsible? And when the lawsuits came, you know, were they the ones that would get it? Currently, there's another case in Illinois on a social worker who was in Children's Protective Services that had a very, very large caseload. And a case of child abuse got by them, or they didn't take the appropriate action, and that child died, and then they were fired. You know, and now fellow workers are saying, yeah, but it was set up in such a way that they couldn't do their job. You know, and so that whole question, you know, should that person have been even trying to do that job?
We had the same one in Minnesota. Exactly.
Yeah, we had this exact same case in Washington as well.
Yeah. Different names.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, and so the question of...
It's probably like that in every state.
Oh, yeah, I think, which, you know, the whole tension between a bureaucratic system and people's rights and also, again, professional responsibility. You know, when you're in a powerless, you're in a fairly powerless situation, and how much do you accede to that system and how much don't you accede to that system?
You know, I have another one that was one reason I got out of it is sales. Anytime you're in sales, where your life depends on the sales, maybe Jim can talk about that. And you're the purveyor of the knowledge and the information, at which point you tell people so much that you destroy the sale, at which point do you not tell them the whole story and let the buyer beware? And when I was in real estate, for instance, you might see termites or bugs and you're not sure they're termites. How far do you go in inspecting for termites yourself? Are they only ants? If you say that termites and they're not, then the seller gets on you, the buyer might lose the sale. And I think that's in a lot of deals, insurance, real estate, financial services, not so much in across-the-counter sales where you're selling one-on-one and they can evaluate the product. Whenever the knowledge is not there on the buyer, I think that's a tremendous personal ethical question.
Mm-hmm. I thought you were about to say something. So.
I?
Yeah. No, I just.
It doesn't have anything to do with that. I was thinking this is in a very small area in ethics in schools. But after, when people ask me what's the difference between when I started teaching 35 years ago and now, I say it's not in the kids. It really has a lot to do with the faculty, and I try to be fair about this. It is a judgment that I'm making, but people want to be professional on the one hand. I think they should be professional to the extent that they take responsibility for the children or high school kids or whatever it is. And I'm seeing young people, not to mention, maybe like in their 30s and 40s, who think they can teach a five-hour day and do all they have to do. And I think, I mean, for me, not accepting responsibility for what I can do is the worst problem that I've seen. A lot of people talk a lot in the faculty room when they should be in their rooms working.
I was teaching, I mean, in many urban areas, I know there's crises in education and the quality of education and the effectiveness of the educational system in doing what it's supposed to be doing. And there's a huge crisis going on in Chicago right now. And we had some speakers come in to, I teach urban policy, and we had someone representing the union and the parents group and stuff like that come and talk to students. And one of the things that we're saying, you know, the teachers should take more responsibility. They have a very powerful union in Chicago. And they should take more responsibility in terms of talking about the weaknesses of curriculum or funding, you know, and not just be as concerned about their pay and stuff and really doing this whole quality kind of thing, taking a professional responsibility. And so the union rep, who didn't disagree in theory on this, is yes, but they're treated only as workers and they're told they can't take any of this kind of responsibility. And they're given these limited roles, so then how can you expect, if you treat them that way long enough, they become like that? You know, if they're not treated as professionals, he says, no teacher, he says, if you look, they're not treated like professionals, therefore they end up being deprofessionalized.
I've heard that.
Right, which is, on one level, a cop-out.
That's right.
You know, but I think it also sort of is the background, you know, of the situation. And it's sort of something that they say a lot in that kind of situation. Do people have other examples? I mean, we've gotten a lot up here. Yeah.
Back to teaching again. In our state, and I still don't know what the source is, but in our district, long about October or so, we get this directive that we have to map out how many minutes we teach reading, how many minutes this, how many minutes that. And it's just an exercise in futility because there's no way you can, and it's per week. And so I was attending a session where a legislator was speaking, and we were told that this was a state directive. And I asked that, and they had never heard of such a ridiculous thing. They say, it's your district. Well, the district says, oh no, it's not the district, it's the legislature. So, but somewhere along the line, and I just keep mine from year to year now, and but new teachers, you know, they think, oh, how do we do this thing? And it's...
You just do what you can.
Yeah.
But you know, you find that you're doing, you find that you lie, at least.
Oh, yeah.
Because
you make it fudge. You only have so many hours in the day.
Right.
But you're spending that time that could be spent much more wisely.
Or what you do is, like this one guy says, you know, the best teachers close the door. And they teach,
and
they hope that the intercom
right.
isn't on, so that the principal isn't listening in. And they do their thing, but then at the end they turn in the form saying that they've done something different.
And yet sometimes along the line, we did have an administrator at one point that if you said in lesson plans, you're on page 42 at 10 o'clock on Tuesday morning, and he came in and you weren't, you know, there were problems. And luckily I've never been in that situation, but...
Are there any other ideas?
I suppose that from our standpoint in law, we always have a conflict between how much work we're going to do for paying clients and how much work we're going to do on a pro bono type basis.
How do you try to resolve that?
Well, we set up a budget for the year. You know, really that's the only way we can do it because we... Otherwise, everybody wants to do their pro bono thing that's important to them, and I use up, you know, all my pro bono hours doing what I think is important. Somebody else does what they think is important. Somebody else does what they think. And pretty quick, we have kind of a hodgepodge, and so now we set up a budget, you know, of hours, because that's how we deal. And, you know, the firm expends so many hours for that, we have to get pro bono projects approved.
How do you decide what percentage of your does the legal profession, like does the American Bar Association suggest every corporation have a certain percentage, or and there's a status quo of how much pro bono work, or is it something that your firm decides and it varies from firm to firm?
We decide. There are canons which say that we should donate time, but that no one prescribes any.
No one says it should be a tie of 10%
or 10% or something like that. Yeah, we don't. And we are probably about 5-7% of the time. Probably something like that.
Yeah. It'd be real interesting. It's too bad we don't have a doctor here, because that becomes a real question too. That one of the problems that I have is that you have doctors were saying, well, it's just too much bureaucracy. I'm not going to take any welfare patients. I mean, we have whole towns in southern Illinois in which it's almost impossible for a young woman to get any birthing service, because you know, if they're impoverished and they're on welfare, and there's very few OB-GYNs, and the combination of the high insurance rates, which is driven some people out of doing OB and just into doing gynae, but literally, you know, that they have to go 4 hours away into Paducah, Kentucky. I love the name of that town. In order to have their baby delivered, you know, and so that the whole question of isn't that, you know, doesn't that profession have a sacred trust? And yet, in fact, it's defined by the marketplace, and so you have a lot of doctors where I live on the near north side of Chicago. You know, you trip over them and trip over hospitals, but in the rural areas of Illinois and in the inner city areas of Chicago, there are less doctors now than there were in the 1940s, which is a pretty staggering statistic. So how is that profession operating ethically?
The only thing I think you have to be careful about is, you know, we can get pretty sanctimonious saying that they should give. Most other businesses, you know, I mean, I think doctors and lawyers stand more accused, and that's because they are in professions, I think, that are deemed to have higher incomes, which isn't always so. But, you know, you can't say they should give so much when, you know, a business person isn't compelled to give. I mean, I think it's a societal problem more than the professions. I mean, the society can't say, you guys give 10% of your time because it's appropriate, and have it affect your income, and society not contribute. I mean, it's sort of like low-income housing. Make developers pay for low-income housing.
Well, the whole question of the philanthropy of corporations and how much do they really give to philanthropy and how serious are they about it? The nonprofit agency I work with, to a large part, functions off the leavings, really, of corporations. You know, it's like get a couple of big grants from, you know, and then get 1,000 from this, 500 from that, and that really puts our budget together. And some of them do it and some of them don't.
Can I make a comment on that? One thing that I take no part of, but I'm some familiar, is the Dayton family, which is a big department store in the Midwest. Their brothers, now the old man started, the brothers, pretty philanthropic, and they started the 5% club, and they're going for 5% of net of all corporations in Minneapolis and Minnesota. And they've got the biggies now. They've got the biggies in Minnesota. A tremendous amount of money goes, and now they're moving that to the 10% club.
That's incredible.
And you're talking about the big companies, the Honeywells and the 3Ms and the Daytons and the Rosemont Engineering, the Control Datas, the Sperry's not located there, but that they're going, and not all of them cooperate, but they all get together and they stroke each other in the golf clubs and in business councils, and the Daytons are very influential. And it has a lot of effect in Minnesota. We have a lot of, I'm not saying we're perfect, but a lot of philanthropic, and they are moving in that direction. Now, where I live in a small town, we don't see that. Mm-hmm. But it's taken some real heavyweights with family money that stayed there and moved into corporations, and then they moved out. The Pillsbury's are another one, same thing. And so they've attacked that a little bit, and not by legislation. Of course, they get the tax deduction.
Right. It'd be interesting to know what arguments they use, whether they use ethical arguments on the basis of ethics and philanthropy, whatever that word is, or taxes.
I think most of those people that I'm talking about, you can't separate them, but the ethics are there. By looking at their history and the culture and the way they treated people, they were not the robber barons, the families. You know, I'm not talking about the Carnegies. I think they probably is poor most in their money, given how they run for politics and the things they've done.
There are some families like that in Chicago. There's this one family, the Lehman family, actually it's three or four families, and they put together Felpro, which is this, I don't even know what Felpro does, but it does a lot of things, and it's a big corporation. And it's interesting a lot because unlike some corporations that, you know, that they have their philanthropy, that they'll give their kind of thing, they have a whole lot of innovative programs for their employees in terms of childcare and stuff like that. They also have a program that they allocate a certain amount of their philanthropic money to their employees. And the employees then decide where the money goes rather than the corporation deciding. And then they have their little family funds for the people within who own the corporation to decide where that money goes. And they try to have most of the corporate giving be partially because they have the employees to find it, so most of their corporate giving ends up being in the communities where the employees live, which is mainly, in this case, minority communities. And it's real interesting to see that because they really had a view of not only were they going to give, but because, in fact, the employees were helping them accumulate the wealth was going to go back into the communities to help the employees or the things that the employees thought were important. You know, we've hit a lot of the areas right now in terms of the question of work and morality. And one area that I just wanted to bring up, because I think you can tell me I'm wrong, but I think it's an area that we don't think of as a moral area per se, but I think as an example of that is the whole civil rights movement, the whole affirmative action movement. Because basically we decided as a society, as a democratic society, that there were certain values we had, and then we imposed them on businesses. You know, and I think that that's an example, and in fact, I think that there's still a battle going on whether we have a right to impose them on businesses. They'll say, well, maybe public government we can impose them on, but can we impose them on businesses? Can we impose them on private groups? You know, from affirmative action, the whole question of pay equity, for example, which we now are starting to impose. Everybody know what pay equity is?
Mm-hmm.
Or comparable worth? It's. I mentioned it a little yesterday. It's the idea that you take a job and by a certain amount of, you first develop some independent criteria of what are the things that you go into deciding what a job, value of a job is, which includes the amount of education, how important it is within the organizational structure of the organization, how dangerous the job is, there's a bunch of different things. And then you give it points. And the idea being that if you end up having 80, if your points are 80, and then if an apple gets 80 and the orange gets 80, so to speak, then they both should get paid the same thing. And when they did that, they found out in many cases that jobs were predominantly male, had males in them. A lot of blue-collar jobs were getting paid even more than they were worth in some cases, and jobs that were predominantly female, nurses are a very good example of that one, were getting paid less than they were getting. And so then with the legislature, so certain people are saying that if you take Equal Opportunities Act and other legislation in terms of affirmative action to its logical conclusion, it isn't just that a male janitor and a female janitor should pay the same thing, but that a male janitor should get paid, a secretary should get paid the same as a janitor, or even get paid more. I'm just, you know, in terms of...
Using an example of that, in our state of Washington here, we went into comparable worth a few years ago, one of the first in the nation, and there's a lady, her name is Gail Spate. She works at Medical Lake. She is a nurse. And one of the reasons she got so involved, she's one of the seven who brought the
class action lawsuit. She's responsible for lives. She's responsible for prescriptions. She does a whole lot of, you know, really tough work, requires education. And she discovered that because she was in a profession largely female-dominated, that she made somewhere like one-third less than a man who didn't have a hospital, didn't even have a high school education, who lifts a few boxes and writes up order forms to order supplies. Simply a maintenance warehouse person. And a nurse with all that education, with all that responsibility, earned a third less in the state pay scale. And that was one of the types of things they used as examples to say, how come?
So then the question becomes, so first of all, it's a question, are we as a society ready to pay in the forms of higher taxes or in terms of redistributing certain things to make up this inequity? We think that if, let's pretend we assume that it's wrong, you know. We assume that it's wrong, we agree that it's wrong, and then how are we going to make up for it? Well, then can we go to a company and say, you have to change your pay scale, or you have to move in the direction of changing your pay scale over 10 years because you have this inequity, or even that you have to pay back some people for this inequity, you know, that you have to do back pay. And that whole question, you know, what is a reason that a business is in being, and how much responsibility does it have to reflect the values of society, and how much ability should society have to control those values? And that whole tension is something I think that we're dealing with. I'm just using this, we can go into other areas, but I think that whole area is one area where ethics and morality and business come in, and I think it really is a moral question. Another area that also comes in some ways is the whole issue of AIDS. Again, what kind of responsibility does the employer have to inform and support his patients? What responsibility does the insurance industry have in terms of, you know, like you're getting a lot of cases now where they know someone is HIV positive. And if what that means is that the antibodies for AIDS have been discovered in your body, it's unclear when and if you will get AIDS. Yeah. I was just...
Well, I shouldn't have flagged.
Oh, okay. And, you know, so the whole question is, and what they often do is that they then don't give people insurance or cut them off from insurance. Is that an appropriate response to the subject? That's something that they should legally be able to do. Because the insurance company is out to make a profit. That's what the insurance company sees as its bottom line. You know, from my point of view, the insurance company is out to make sure that I don't pay through my nose and that I can be ill and still financially go through the illness. That's what I think the purpose of an insurance company is. But that isn't the purpose of the insurance company.
But on the other hand, if they are supporting enough people who do get AIDS, their rates will have to be raised to such a level that it's unaffordable for people to get insurance. That's the catch-22 of the way that our insurance system runs now.
Right. Because of what they're going to make sure is that they're going to maintain that profit margin. Mm-hmm. You know,
or
that
go
that's
out of business.
Or
go out of business.
Right.
I generally would be on, I would argue on the other side. I have a sister whose husband runs an insurance company, and she's always giving me
Here's a bombshell to throw out. Is it not true that almost every other industrialized country, East and West, has some form of basic, minimal medication that everyone has some at least minimal right to participate in, and they can do extra and pay more if they're able to?
You're talking about national health insurance, or some form.
I hate to use the word socialized, but in general, you go and you don't have to be poverty-stricken to get some help.
Well, only the United States and South Africa are the only two countries that don't have some form of nationalized system of health. It could, you know, Canada has a system. Great Britain, all the Scandinavian countries, Germany. I mean, all of the northern.
Scandinavian countries are way up here. That's the ultimate almost.
That's the Cadillac, huh?
That's the Cadillac. Mm-hmm.
And that adds to your comment about the insurance rates. If it's so unfair, some people are going to be denied. Mm-hmm. They have to spend everything they and their families have saved for 40 years. Then at that point, maybe, they can get something, even if it's to go on welfare, and which, as you point out, there are a lot of doctors and hospitals that are not real charmed to accept welfare coupons.
That's right. So then you have that issue. You have the issue of civil rights, of people's rights, the conflict that could conflict with if the raison d'etre of the company is to make money. Is that why a company should be in business? To make money. To make the most money possible, to squeeze the most blood from the rock, right?
Let me take the side of the capitalist, because I think that. And I think that works in things that we see every day, and it works fairly well in clothing. We have incredibly cheap clothing, relatively speaking, or food, being in the Midwest. You have incredibly cheap food because when somebody makes too much money, somebody else jumps in. I'm not saying there's not some cartelization in the big grain companies and some of those games, but So to argue that their goal is not to make money, you're then arguing the whole tenets of your capitalist system. Now, if you want to change that, that's another question.
Right.
That's
and
not what
she
was saying, though. She was saying, is it to capitalism
just make the most
to maximize
money.
Profits,
right.
But at the same time,
ethical behavior.
Well, it's a question. You know, you said walk over your mother's grave. You should do it as long as you don't walk over your mother's
grave.
There's
some ethics, I think, that
right.
society places on everybody. But if I'm a corporation and I'm selling a product, let's say I'm selling cars, and there's a line of people outside that door, and I price that car at $9,000, and the line is 100 people, I'm going to raise the price to $11,000. And pretty soon the line comes down to 50, I'll raise it to 15. Now I might be making incredible profits, and then you people say, well, you greedy, grubby little capitalist. The fact remains, and Rick's going to see that I'm making $10,000 a car. By that, he's going to build cars, and the price will drop.
You're saying the market
adjusts
for it.
Yeah,
it will work.
But I have
the problem gets into is in healthcare and moral questions, and that's then where I tend to get on the flip side. I say, maybe on healthcare, that's not right. You don't want the market to do those things because it writes certain civil rights. I think that's your hypothesis.
Right.
But we've got to be very careful where we draw those lines.
Well, the question is, what's your mother's grave? In other words, I mean, in the kind of situation, and different people have different view of what the line is. Like, for example, in your, I'm just using the car example. All right, so I'm trying to make as much profit out of the car. Now, the question is, to what point can I do that? And this gets back to the let the buyer beware question. Now, if I could make an unsafer car and make more money from it, is that all right? In other words, let the buyer beware.
Ford did that with a gas tank, $15 item, and it caused a lot of deaths.
So, and then
exactly
the, so then what the society says, no, because in the cost to society. So when does it become a cost to the society? Because then we, in deaths or insurance or in Maine people, have to pick up from that. And that's the same thing that's happening now in terms of the seat belts and the airbags.
That's because what lawyers like Rick can have enough money to contribute 5% of their gross.
But that, I mean, that becomes a real big question. In other words, can you cut your profits or make your product less attractive but make it safer because society says that way? Another area where that morality comes in is, which is a bill that the president just signed, I think, which was the question of, and a lot of question about it, was the question of a plant moving from one place to another and the kind of notice that they have to give. In other words, again, taking Scandinavia, but a lot of European countries have it, that if a plant moves, it has to give adequate notice to the government and the community, and there has to be certain training programs in place, or retraining programs for those workers. In this country, the idea, well, if you can make more money, you could close a plant today and move it to the south or move it to Korea, because you're looking, and that may, and on one hand, well, they have the freedom to do it, that a corporation is in fact a legal individual, and just like we have rights to take our passport and move, doesn't that corporation have the same rights, with other people saying, well, no, it's different, affects other people's lives. The community has built roads and taxed itself in order for this corporation to exist. It's going to be, people have made certain changes in their lives and moved to this community and have put a certain number of years and invested in this job, and therefore there should there the company has some responsibility in that transition to do certain things, even though they might lose money in doing those kinds of things.
That's of course what happened here in 1957. Mm-hmm. They just closed it one day. They had no notice. Mm-hmm. They heard rumors, but they had no notice whatsoever.
So that whole question is another question where I think it's morality, responsibility to the whole community, as opposed to the bottom line, which I think, you know, the point that you just argued earlier is that, you know, that question, it is to make profit. You know, if you don't make profit, you don't exist. And so at what point do you decide, and how do you juggle this?
Let me propose to you, why don't you say the bottom line is the law?
The law?
But is there a lot of cover in the situation?
Individuals participate in making these decisions. Individuals have moral codes and can have some influence on the decisions. The gas tank. People, engineers, scientists, administrators knew what was going on. They knew what would happen. And they went ahead and did it. Now, the idea was an additional extra dirty poultry bucks instead of honest, clean, fair, good, ethical product. And behavior and ethical questions come in there. Profit, yes, but reasonable profit, giving good product for the service.
I don't think we have any too good of examples of that. Now, it seems to me the bottom line is what you have to do. It's not, you know, in environmental concerns and so on. You only do what the letter of the law says you have to do, and you're not willing to do anything more.
There are
some rare circumstances, but that's generally...
There was an interesting article that I read in one of the newspapers, and I can't tell you if it's in these Times or the Christian Science Monitor, you know, it was like as I was getting my fix of news stories for the day. And what it was is this person was talking about the ozone crisis and then saying the irony is that the same companies who created the ozone problem are now probably going to go into the business of solving it and making money on their ability to solve it. And this guy was like, that's wrong, that's immoral, you know.
Sure. Well, I think a good example of what ethics would be like the tobacco companies today. I mean, they sell a product where they know from the results of their own research and from others that it's harm, but there was a guy, I mean, Fortune magazine, the guy that's the CEO of Reynolds said, you know, as long as this product is legal, I'm going to sell it. You don't want this product to be sold and me to make money off of it, then you make this product illegal. And, you know, it's a hard-boiled attitude, but that was definitely his attitude.
And if you make a law that makes it unlawful for me to sell it, I'll do it in Japan and I'll do it in Pakistan.
Well, they have to make laws, that's
right. They're doing it now.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right, the whole dumping thing is a lot of infant form. I mean, food products, infant formulas, medical kinds of things.
There was a PBS special on that recently about smoking in the Philippines.
Which is your argument that the bottom line, society has to decide what the bottom line is and tell the business community that. The business community cannot be expected, what you're saying, to be ahead of the rest of us on these kind of subjects unless we're willing to impose our will.
It's also going to cost you money. See, and what you want to do is throw the cost to somebody else, and you don't want to face the fact it's going to cost you money. And, I mean, I'll give an example of a lot of us up here at this camp. We're all basically white upper middle classes. You sit and listen to people's values. Not everybody's wealthy. And we're going to talk about poverty and solving problems. The problem of poverty is going to cost you some bucks, either in taxes or work free or something. It's not going to happen because General Motors owns a new plant in Detroit. It's going to cost you money in relatively large amount. So we, as a group of people, talk about these things. When the bottom line comes down, we don't do anything about it because now that means I don't get that extra VCR, that second car, or the trip to Holden where I can stroke myself and feel good about these issues. And I'm not condemning people here in the room, but that's society in general. And so you can't sit back and throw it all at somebody else and not affect you. It will cost, it's going to cost big bucks, and it's easier not to face the issue and let the poor be there and have my two cars.
So I think a lot of the staff here try to, I think many of them have made commitments to simple lifestyle. And here it's easy to do that. On the outside, it's much harder when you're faced with other people whose values are more materialistic.
Right, you got to pay your water bill and your heat bill.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, kids got to have shoes and go to school.
Well, I agree with you in that, and that is that not only true with Americans, but mankind.
Right.
We're trying to produce something at the cheapest possible way to get the greatest profit. I mean, that's capitalism, okay? And we don't build into it a natural factor of what it costs to get rid of the dregs and the leftovers of whatever the process is. Mm-hmm. And that should have been done at the beginning.
Right.
We should have been educated that way.
Mm-hmm.
To not piss where you drink water.
Well, okay, we talked about nationalized medicine. I know we have relatives in Denmark, and I know a little bit about that. I mean, they're in their 70s and they still do a little work. They're taxed horrendously. I mean, my wife's one cousin knits. She knits 80, 90 sweaters a year. And the government takes about half of that.
Mm-hmm.
50% taxation.
Yeah, costs.
But they're taken care of.
Sure. And what happens is, like my girlfriend's mother in that situation, you know, whenever she had some problems with her knees for a couple of years, she would call and they would send a cab and take her to the doctor. They brought in a housekeeper. You know, all those, she paid for it though. She had always paid for it. But on the other hand, it actually delivered, you know, back to her. And the question is whether, you know, the people here really don't have a real good relationship or a willingness to do
it. You want to kill the goose that lays the golden egg is the argument. How much do you squeeze the capitalists? And I didn't want to squeeze them personally, but I know the argument both sides very well. And there are people out there that will work, and I know them, but they're going to work way more hours than the rest of us. They're not working 8 hours a day. I mean, they're working 15, 20 hours a day creating. Okay, and why do they do that? Is it power? Is it money? At what point in time do you shut those people off in a society? If you look at the countries that are economically successful, you let them run. Now, and those countries that produce tremendous amount of wealth, they don't tackle people to death and you let them have all their goodies and their bennies. I don't say like that, but those countries do produce.
But for example,
the Union's going to go nowhere.
Germany, for example, has produced. But it has a lot, you know, so the question is at what point, what do you need to produce? Because that argument is true, but Western Europe, their people are producing, their competitors.
Now, Sweden is high unemployment, though, in Germany, and on top of that, they treat Turks very second-class citizens.
Right.
When the labor is short, they bring Turks in, and then when the labor gets, they just send them back home to sit in the village
so
and smoke hash.
So they're not pure either.
And there's not high unemployment.
No, I'm not saying it, but the question becomes, and this is one of the things that we have to decide, is again, what is the bottom line?
That's right.
What is the mix that we need in our society in order for it to have the values and the vision that we want it to have on one hand, and to function at what we consider to be an appropriate level of material comfort.
You know, this may seem off the subject, but years ago, in the 1960s, I read an author named Ayn Rand. There are several books, some theoretical and on the subject of capitalism, and one famous one called Atlas Shrugged.
It's a novel,
but even though it's a novel,
it really gets into the issues of the marketplace and the individual who is ethical running the marketplace without the interference and the overseeing of the government. And it does come up with some good arguments that are very relevant. I can only recommend that it does give a philosophy of the benefits within capitalism, as long as you just don't go way overboard in it.
See, one of the things that I, you know, there's, I just want to throw out a few things, and I would like to get to the closing discussion, which is what prevents people from being ethical. You know, what do we think prevents people from doing it, and what does it need? But I just want to throw one of the other areas, you know, one that Floyd brought up, which is the whole areas of environmental stuff and the products, the waste you produce. You know, and that whole question, how do you ethically figure out that? I mean, and you can go from people who ethically say, well, you know, what happens if you start to really think about what Boeing is producing? You know, can you then ethically work for Boeing? You know, how do you figure that one out? To a company that, you know, really is polluting the river and stuff like that, and how do you, as an employee of that company, how do you decide if you're going to work for them or not when it's the only game in town? How does a steel worker in the southeast side of Chicago, what kind of responsibility do they have? Not only what kind of responsibility does the corporate leader have, which we've sort of been talking about the corporate leader, but what kind of responsibility does the worker to say, hey, you know, if we don't change these practices, this is going to happen, you know, and then saying that their union or they as an individual or they'll leave when, you know, what kind of, how are they going to be judged, so to speak, in terms of their ethical behavior if they didn't leave that situation? And the last one, which isn't work, is investment. You know, if I keep my money in Citicorp or something like that, what does, then am I acceding to their investment policies? You know, and how much time do I take to figure out where my investment? So all of these issues are ethical issues. So my question is, as I said, what prevents people from being ethical? We've talked about these situations, whether they're individual quality situations. What do and we've sort of said some of this stuff, but let's.
I think initially it's in part even when as you, when you the way you raise the question is problematic because how do we know what is what and is there a clear definition of what is ethical? I mean, I think that's the basis of the problem. In talking about...
I can't spell, so people will discover my weakness in life. I think is this an S to the Venus or something?
Balancing economic realities and with what otherwise one might think is ethical changes the picture. You know, you might have a very purist kind of ethical system, but is that realistic when you look at the realities you're facing of the way production has to work?
Paying the mortgage. So.
Mm-hmm.
Right. How can that steel worker?
Yeah, right.
I spell mortgage.
M-O-R-T.
G-H.
Is this it?
G-H.
G-H.
You got it.
There's enough. We know what you mean.
No, it'd be interesting to also ask the question, what makes people ethical?
Okay. What makes people ethical?
What motivates people to
you know, it might be a religious faith here, you know. I haven't talked about that too much.
Mm-hmm.
It could be that I have a lot of dealings with Islam, with students, lots of them in my office, and they bring me Palestinian flags and gifts and dinners and all that stuff. We're really pretty close with them. And they are, if we want to talk about ethics, the ones who practice Islam are more ethical as a whole than the Christians, I say. There's some religious belief, I don't want to get into Jesus Christ and Muhammad, but I think that, and you see it when you look at other religions, maybe from your the outside more. Incredibly ethical behavior and what is right and wrong. And I think it's religious beliefs.
I just wrote this down. It's almost an integration or holistic view of religion. In other words, the question of is when you open that door and you go to work,
Do you bring your community values or your religious values with you into that workplace?
In Islam, there's no question you do. Period. Everything.
I don't know anything about Islam, but
Christians do
well. I do know. Rights of women, I hear.
Yeah. Well, and they, I mean, you know, but as an idea, anyway. Yeah.
They're incredibly dedicated. And I don't know that that is necessarily whether they are. You could be dedicated and not be ethical, you know. And I don't know if dedication and hijacking airplanes and killing off people and dropping them out and things like that, I don't know how ethical that is, but they're certainly dedicated.
Well, there's a flip side to every coin, so, like being totally moral and religious. I'm just giving about everything. Right.
But then during the Crusades, we were not very ethical when we tried to stuff Christianity down people's throats and so on, and sent the sordid people to. That doesn't sound very well.
Well, when does this become intolerance is the question.
In South and so on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where does that line go?
I think one of the differences between Islam and Christianity as it's generally practiced now in this country is that the discipline involved in the beliefs. I think that I'm not sure if most Islamic people in this country practice the same kind of religious discipline, but they're prayers twice a day, isn't that true? In other kind of five times.
Well, I want to throw something. I want to say that Islam, and I'm just, I mean, whether we're, let's take it, let's pretend we're right about it. You know, it might be we could make all these examples and show how it isn't ethical. Let's pretend we're right. That it's a medieval religion, that it has never become a capitalist religion, that their society as a whole is still in a different place, which has a whole other, a lot of weaknesses in it, like the rights for women and a lot of things in terms of family law. When what's happened is at some point in the development of capitalism and free marketplace and free ideas and a whole lot of good things that happened with industrialization is we fragmented a lot of parts of us.
We separated religion out.
We separated religion out, and we separated the family out.
Well, Lutherans know that from Martin Luther. We've got to get through the Catholics.
Well, some of us are still back there. I mean, you know, the Catholics broke away from my church. I'm even further back. I'm Greek Orthodox.
Are you really Greek Orthodox?
Huh? Yeah.
Sure, you're the real true ones.
Right. One step away. But anyway, but this whole question of how integrated, you know, whether it's religious morality or community morality, however you want to do it, and how much you bring those values. You know, I always think of, you know, I mean, sort of the absolute image I have, we'll say, of some, you know, how there's this mafia businessman who's great with his family and a nice neighbor, you know? I mean, that myth, whether it's a true myth or not, is an example for all. Okay, so we're saying the question of paying the mortgage, that we have no consensus on the subject, and that we, and do we have any, do we, are we really motivated? Is it something in the whole question of integration? Are there other things that are preventing us from being?
We don't have enough power sometimes to effect the changes we would be willing to try to. We can try to attempt, but when you get defeated a lot,
this is especially be true of the employee more.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is,
but it's true of all of us. To think about.
I think too. One thing we do is we really protect each person's right to assert what they perceive as morality or religion. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, we have so many rights in this country that they really get in the way. In the sense that you mentioned, we need to bring our religion in there, but we protect the rights of the agnostics or the atheists, the people that don't want to participate in that. And we have, you know, spent a lot of our time and energy protecting each person's right to assert things as they see it, and it makes things real and efficient.
I was thinking as you were talking how about things that I think of are strengths when they get taken to an extreme become weaknesses. You
That's
know what
right.
I And, you know, and sort of just sort of understanding that.
And we spend so much time sorting out where we are along the line between, you know, the strength and the weakness.
If you put all the things that we are and we have in an order of priority, I think ethics would not be very close to the top. It's just like finding a good place to dispose of our trash. I mean, I'm all for that, but not in my backyard. And I think that's true of many things. I mean, we like our way of life, what we've gotten used to, and obviously, if it means some kind of a departure from that, wouldn't be very happy. We probably wouldn't be very happy with a lower lifestyle where we get along with things and we wouldn't have as much as we have now.
Yeah, it's a question. What are we willing to give up?
Sure.
You know, in some areas, sure. I don't own a VCR, but I have a car and I drive my car more than I use public transportation and I like to travel, so that's one thing I wouldn't be willing to give up. But, you know, trade-offs.
I make a comment on what he said. I deal with a lot of the very topics in a class I teach at the university, and they were in 30, 40 kids a quarter and three classes, 100, 120 kids. And there's absolutely no question in my mind, they're becoming very self-centered, they're not going to give up, and what we're talking about is we're warm-fuzzing ourselves, and those people are going to go out and make bucks, buy VCRs and drive cars, and they're going to drive Porsches, and that is it. And they are not socially concerned, period. I don't mean they're evil. They're not going to walk over their mother's grave. They're lines with relationships they won't cross. But in terms of what you're saying, they are, these young people nowadays, no question in my mind. Now, I got to be careful. I'm not speaking of Berkeley, but I'm dealing with where we graduate, just my department in college is 500 to 1,000 a quarter. I'm talking a college of 15,000. You know, we're talking about large numbers of people cranking through the system, and you just do not. So you can't get a protest, you can't get no involvement in social issues in class, they have no interest in it, and all I care about is making money.
You know, I think one of the problems, and I mean, I see this among the students, we get juniors, and some of them come to Chicago to study urban policy and to work for nonprofits, and others because we have a very good internship program, and it gives them a leg up in the advertising industry and a bunch of stuff like that, the commodities exchange. You know, so I have a rather broad grouping. And one of the things I think is true, that our educational system is at fault, which goes back to our consensus on what's ethical and ethics are a low priority, is we really don't teach people. I mean, there's one question, you know, which is the religious question, but we don't even teach people very well how to think or how to apply values and analyze in terms of the whole picture. And there's some things like the whole question of the Porsche and stuff like that. I mean, but no one thinks it through. What is my action? If I make this decision, how is that decision going to affect a whole group? And analyzing it back and forth, and how is a whole group's going to decision to go back? And we don't teach that. We don't teach that kind of analysis. I mean, people could then come to the same conclusion that they're still going to do it for themselves and protect themselves.
But they've never thought about it.
That's what I'm saying. It isn't even that they've had a lot of thinking about it, and then having thought about it and come to a conclusion. Like you say, these aren't evil people, you know, who've consciously made certain choices. By doing this, I'm going to hurt this, you know, that I'm going to destroy the ozone layer, and therefore all these people are going to have cancer, and what this is going to mean three generations down the line. You know, I don't think, and we don't teach things in an analytical way where people are going to think these things.
I think by virtue of the department that he teaches in, you see a lot more of
in
other areas. There still are those people that are very much concerned about these issues, but In the last 5 years, there has been definitely a decrease in the number of people that are going into the sciences, and there has been a definite increase in those that are going into business of some aspect or another,
and an increase in abortions. 3 abortions per certain young women by the time they're 17 or 18. And I know something that some of you don't know. Allegedly, abortions are not being paid for by public funds, fiddlesticks in the state of Washington.
Well, it depends on the state government. Mm-hmm. But you were interested?
I think we're a lot too late when we're thinking about educating people in college to this awareness.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a family issue that you need to start when children, not even school, I think at home. And that's where part of the problem is, because there's no home foundation for so many kids that come to me. And so it's too late when they get to high school or when they get to college.
But I think you could also teach, I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you, and that's what I was saying, that in terms of the kind of foundations that the community gives outside of the schools, but I was just saying in the way that we think of education, in terms of learning how to think and analyze, mm-hmm. I think that it would be helpful if we thought of things that way and thought of it rather than thinking of it, again, in very fragmented kind of parts. I would say that there's a problem where, I can't remember, what was it, the geographic location where people didn't know where it is?
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm just saying? I mean, there is a problem when people can't even place themselves in terms of where they live as compared to where other people live. And, that's a form of isolation which leads to individualism, which leads to weak thinking. I'm not saying if everybody knows where Tanzania is that they will be a good, upright person. But I really think that and something that you said earlier, which is a sense of powerlessness combined together, it's part of the formula. And we are going to have to end this officially for the tape.
Isn't part of back to our educational system, though, we demand so much of our educational system, and we're giving it so little support, and when they need it, like first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, they're not getting values judgments, they're not getting ethical class thinking, they're not getting geography to understand what's going on. They're being required to do different types of things. Lots of arts and lots of crafts are neat, but they don't give you the foundation to do.
In Chicago, we don't have arts and crafts. They cut it out years ago along with sports. They don't put money into the educational system. So for Chicago, that isn't the problem. The problem is that they aren't willing to invest. Again, it's the society is not willing to pay for that education.